Mental health and wellness are crucial aspects of well-being. Their understanding and acceptance are vital for the progress of society. In a cultural context, mental health is often shrouded in stigma and misunderstanding, leading to a lack of proper support and care for those affected. Heal Your Mind with Tracy Cotson is a platform for candid conversations that enlighten and enrich our understanding of mental health and wellness. Join us as we demystify, destigmatize, prioritize, and shine a light on mental health and healing. Heal Your Mind podcast with Tracy Cotson is hosted by Mental Wellness Initiative and supported by the Ford Foundation.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our podcast on unpacking the stigma of male gender-based violence and addressing the impact on their mental health. I'm Tracy Cotson, the CEO of the Mental Wellness Initiative. And with me in studio, we have Mr. Daniel Mofokeng, who is a career military serviceman until his retirement and decided very wisely, sir, to spend his retirement years focusing on gender-based violence and addressing the various social ills affecting women and girls. We have Martin Pelders, who is the founder of Matrix Men and a strong advocate for men's mental health. Joining us remotely, we have Nozuko Majola from SANAC, the South African National AIDS Council. She's the technical lead for social and structural drivers related to HIV. And we have Elliot Mabaso, also from SANAC, who is the technical support of the Gender-Based Violence National Strategic Plan for South Africa. Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you and good morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So our conversation today is about men and mental health, and it's a very intersectional discussion. There are lots of things that influence this space, but I want to kick off with you, Martin. Matrix Men really looks at advancing this conversation around men and mental health. So from your work, can you help us understand a little bit more about what the stigmas are and maybe define stigma for us first and then tell us what are you seeing in terms of men having open spaces to talk about mental health issues?
Hi, Tracy. Yeah, thanks. The stigmas behind men and mental health is that we're kind of taught from a very young age that you just don't talk about things. Just suck it up, move on. Get on with it. Don't cry. So cowboys don't cry or tigers don't cry. You know, and that sort of narrative that is constantly pushed onto little boys. You know, we're not allowed to feel emotions. And sadly, that leaves us with kind of five coping mechanisms as adult males. We have what I call the five coping mechanisms would be anger, addiction, sex, silence, and sport.
Mm-hmm.
So quite often men just resort to one of those five issues. They kind of just withdraw into themselves, spend the whole weekend playing golf, spend the whole weekend watching soccer on television, or they just get silent. They just withdraw into themselves, or they're constantly out trolling for different women because that's going to prove their masculinity, or they use the anger, which is where the gender-based violence comes in, or they're going to use the addiction. And sadly, when men use those five coping mechanisms, then we get that wonderful hashtag that has gone around the world, men are trash. And I'm going, no, men are broken. They're not trash. They're just broken. And they've never been given a space to be able to talk about what it is that they deal with. We can look at the military environment that Daniel comes out, go to war, come back from war, get thrown out and say, well, thank you for your service. Bye-bye. Deal with it. Cope with it. There's no follow-up. There's no support. You know, I mean, I know my brothers were in on the border in the 70s, horrific scenes that took place there. I was in the military in the 80s. I used to fly to the border and fly back with plane loads of bodies. And we're never given the skills. We're not allowed to talk about it. We're not allowed to unpack it. Just deal with it, you know. And boys have been dealing with it for so long that they just don't know how to do it anymore. And we need to create those spaces where they can come in and just talk about it, because that's when healing begins, is when we start to talk about it. We need to break that narrative that, you know, cowboys don't cry. No, in fact, cowboys do cry. In fact, the strongest boys cry and deal with their things and unpack it and just create a safe space where men can come in and talk about issues that they're facing and that they're dealing with.
Mm. Martin, thank you. That it's so insightful. I mean, I'm raising two sons, right? And I was being very deliberate about my parenting, teaching emotional intelligence and the names of our emotions and creating safe space. I mean, it's funny, but it's not funny. Somebody had said to me years ago that men have three emotions, happy, sad, and hungry. And I was like, wow, hungry is an emotion now. But in fact, you're so right. We have stripped men of the language for emotions, of the right to have emotions, and of the spaces to talk about that. And when you bottle all of that up, it then becomes those five dysfunctional, in fact, coping mechanisms.
I always say that I often in my groups, I'll ask men for emotions.
Mm.
And it's weird that they always start with anger.
Mm.
And there's got to be a reason for that. But men on average will come up with about between 7 and 8 emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if I ask women for words for emotions, I'll be here until next week.
Yeah, we can keep going.
And that in itself is a teller, a strong teller that we don't raise our sons with EQ, with emotional quotient. Mm. And we need to change that narrative.
And of course, it was in war where we first discovered post-traumatic stress disorder, right? They were the first inklings of it after the Second World War, and then the Vietnam War gave us the full diagnosis of that. Daniel, maybe to you now, just in your capacity as a, and thank you for your service to the country, in your capacity as a career serviceman, what were your experiences around men and mental health?
No, thank you, Tracy. Thank you for the panel. I think on the question of the mental health regarding men, I must say, I'll talk from the observation as when you are managing men and women for decades, you tend to understand them, their approaches, etc. But it has been very difficult for men to come out in terms of the problems they applied. I think that originates from the socialization we had or got. As Martin is saying, we were raised from the environment that cowboys don't cry, men don't cry, or you'll be told in the community that you are a man, don't behave like a woman, whilst you are trying to express yourself to say, but I am not feeling well on this matter. So we encourage the soldiers or service people to see the psychologists. You know, in the military, you have everything. It's a world of its own. You've got social workers, you've got clinical psychologists, etc., and so on and so forth. But men, it will not be easy for a man to tell you that they say, I went for this. I want assistance in this direction. But for women, you can sit. I should tell you, I've been traumatized, this and that and that, and you get into that. For me, it was some sort of evolving in as far as men is concerned, and that we had the facility to handle that in terms of military health service, that is having all the specialists to take care of that. The issue raised by Martin, that after the service, you are left alone, etc. To a certain extent, it is true. But when you are still serving, there are those facilities and opportunities to try to some sort of fight those traumatic situations that you have seen. But when I go into the communities, as I indicated earlier on, I realized that men are even reluctant to participate in the campaign to combat GBV. The first reaction will be, but you people, you don't take into account that we are also abused. There is that element. Mm-hmm. That's why I take this topic as very important to open up, to unleash that potential to attract men into coming out. For instance, in my foundation, we partnered with the entities like Lifeline, which provides psychological, psychiatric, clinical counseling, etc. We saw it very important. We had to sit down with them to say, you know, we're engaged in this in the township, but we realize that men are not forthcoming, men are affected, and they are some sort of reluctant, because when you confess as a man, because I'm a man, you are taken as a weakling and you'll be ridiculed all over, etc. So I take that this opportunity, this presentation as extremely important as a first measure to open up, because in the African communities, it is not very easy to say that. I know in areas like Soweto and others, there are initiatives like Kulumandoda, meaning that you must talk how you're abused by a partner, how you're abused by your girlfriend, false reporting of GBV, etc., and so on. There is that bitterness, and even if I try to mobilize some of them to say, let's get into the project, they say, but be careful, we are having this challenge. Mm-hmm. So I must say, what we are talking about, it's real and it needs attention.
Mm. Thank you, Daniel. And just, you're talking about the Paul Mchimofokeng Charity Development Foundation, for anyone who wants to look up the work that you do. Right. So I want to go across to Nozuko. Nozuko, and just a reminder to the listeners, looks after social and structural drivers around HIV. Nozuko, what are you seeing in that space between HIV and mental health, particularly as it affects men? What are you seeing that you can share with us?
Thank you, Trace. With regard to men, first and foremost, when we talk about HIV, there is a perception that men actually, they avoid healthcare services. Their health-seeking behaviors are very low. And because of that, they tend to run away from even going to the health facilities for testing, because they are always scared of finding out about their HIV status. And that creates a problem when you talk about GBV and mental health and HIV, because most women, they find themselves being victimized by their male partners, because if a woman goes to a clinic and test positive, which they are forced to go to the clinic, especially if they are pregnant, and they come back and they announce to the family that, or to the husband, that actually I'm HIV positive. And because men cannot deal with those traumatic issues as compared to women, they find it difficult. And in our space, we find that it's important that you bring both partners together and announce the results that came out of that process. But instead of acknowledging that I might have been the one who brought the epidemic into the household, they end up criticizing the woman, and then GBV happens. So I've seen it in many scenarios, especially as men are regarded as providers within the households. When they lose employment, there is always that expectation. And you find that this thing of the expectation, the societal expectation that men are providers, it also impacts in their mental health, and they are looking at their health-seeking behaviors as well. It becomes difficult for them to go and ask for help just to deal with their mental issues or coping mechanism. And then they will cope differently, as Martin has said, you know, those five areas that he mentioned. In fact, I liked it, because now it enlightened me as well to say, okay, so men have got only five coping mechanisms that they they utilize in order to cope with issues. And in many other times, we are always looking at the fact that, of course, they will be angry, and then they will also inflict violence to the people that are weaker within the family. And there is also another expectation that men should always be strong in whatever space. But and we tend to forget, especially people who are working with women, many a times we forget that men are also human beings, and they've got mental health issues that they also have to deal with. And that tendency, especially from a feminist side, of saying men are the perpetrators of violence without peeling the onion deeper, just to understand what is causing this violent man. Because a man who was not violent, who was known not to be violent, if an event happens in his life, because of being a human being, then he tend to these five things that Martin has mentioned, which one of them, a noticeable one, will be violence, of course.
Thank you for introducing us to the onion. I think in layers, when I'm thinking about how, you know, social structures work and these driving forces work. So, and I love the idea of an onion, because we can always keep, you know, peeling back a layer and drilling down deeper and not accepting things at face value. I find it very interesting, your comment about men have a lower predisposition to seeking help. And that's across the board, Nozuko. So it's not just mental health, right? You're talking HIV counseling, and I'm assuming you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that might then extend to other medical services that they might need. So does that sound broader, is what I'm saying? It's much broader than mental wellness. So the stigma that's keeping men from seeking help for mental wellness issues is actually driving other behaviors which are physically really detrimental for them.
That's correct, Tracy. In fact, we've seen it. I used to work for Department of Social Development, and I happened to work with the ex-mine workers in the Eastern Cape, who felt that since they've lost employment, even their wives, they undermine them because they no longer bring money into the family. And it goes further to a point where a woman will even bring a girlfriend, and in front of the men, you know, undermine the men to a point. And men cannot tolerate that, because the expectation from the community is such that no woman should undermine you, you know. And then when, because I was working for social development at that time, I even suggested that maybe you should go to and see the social workers. And even that, it's not easy for a man. Going to the police station is also not easy, because there will be a laughing stock of the community, because it's not, the expectation is that you cannot be undermined by a woman, and forgetting that women can also be cruel towards their men.
And and I'm glad you brought that up, because we need to unpack that a little bit more. I want to go to you, Elliot. You look after, within the SANEC environment, you look after the National Strategic Plan on Gender-Based Violence from a technical support point of view. And I know that the NSP tends to say it's victim-focused and frames the victim as being a woman who is suffering from gender-based violence. And we know GBV is a lot of things. I'll talk about domestic violence, rape and sexual assaults. There's financial abuse, psychological abuse, emotional abuse, and so forth. So we're using GBV as just a cluster term for that. So Elliot, noting that the NSP talks to a woman as a victim and then centers the female victim, how do you engage around men and their mental health, and potentially men who are themselves victims of those things that I've just listed, domestic violence, sexual assaults, psychological and emotional abuses, and so on?
Firstly, coming into the work of GBV, even for myself, the first thing one needed to understand is what is gender, and the spectrum of gender needs to be understood, because we need to understand the power dynamics that come with, you know, one identifying or presenting a particular gender identity. And, you know, the first, you know, piece of work we needed to do from our side in terms of the NFE, yes, we see that the victims are women. But when you think about a theory of change, we really need to start thinking, what kind of a South Africa do you want to build? And who needs to be engaged to ensure that we are able to, you know, build that actual vision of success? So for me, the first basis was, you know, as a South African man myself who identifies as, you know, LGBT, I needed to understand what does GBV mean to me and how does that reflect in my instance. And then also try to see how each and every person, you know, comes into the picture. And when you spoke earlier about, you know, stigma and where the stigma comes from, especially from men, and how we are, you know, socially constructed to behave a certain way. So for me, it was even much more challenging for someone who might not fully, you know, identify with particular social construct in terms of what a man is and how you identify as a man. So I think for me, the first instance was being able to identify yourself and, you know, have that sense of, a sense of belonging to say, I belong or I'm this kind of a man. So luckily, you know, being able to be engaged at 17 with, you know, an organization that works with key population made me understand the difference between my masculine traits and my feminine traits and how to dip into both of those to be able to function. Because, I mean, the main idea of those two, you know, aspects of humanity is being able to function and how one is able to acknowledge, you know, their masculine and effeminate side and be able to access those when needed. And a lot of times when you think about, you know, a man, it's how those aspects are taken away in terms of, you know, dipping into your effeminate aspect, which then would force you to take care of yourself. And like you said, beyond just mental health, when you go to the clinic, you don't find a lot of men there. So now the conversation starts going back to saying, yes, the women are victims, but, you know, we can help as many victims as possible. But it's very important to also think about how we can assist the perpetrators and the core essence of where the challenges come from that enforces them to behave in a particular manner. So we need to really look at the community as a whole and understand the challenges that forces the people to act in a particular manner. I think Mamnoza would remember when we were doing a theory of change, which is a dialogue with young men, and we were trying to understand for them, you know, what can be done to assist young men. And we had a group of young boys from Social Nguve, and, you know, one of the main things that they were always speaking about is how they lacked a role model, a male role model within their spaces that they can identify. So we go back to that, you know, need for one to be able to identify and link themselves and be inspired by someone. So there's a bit of a lack when it comes to that aspect for men. A lot of men don't have that direct line of, you know, people who are role models, for instance, and can, you know, inspire and promote positive change and behavior in one's life. I think even for myself, within the family construct, it's very difficult to start conversations about your own emotions as a man and have a space or know that you are allowed to be able to express yourself in that essence. So we really need to think about, you know, the household of a South African a family and what influences come from, you know, religious backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, and really the economy itself, poverty, and all the other things that we are seeing within a community, and how that can influence a young man. So my thoughts are just really just on that aspect, just starting off.
In fact, just to add on what Elliot was saying, you know, one of the things that we are noticing as we are engaging with multiple communities or even service providers. Service providers are not recipient of the fact, are not welcoming and understanding that, you know, even men can also suffer from mental health issues. Even men are different. Even, you know, creating that enabling environment is even difficult for service provider, which further push men away from seeking health and services from even our service providers. At some point when we're doing gender-based violence, we had to even talk about gender diversity and inclusion to the social workers so that they understand that they will, as they are working in the communities, they will come across different types of people, and they must be able to accommodate all different types of people despite their gender preferences. So we ended up looking even at our programs to say when we must not go with the assumption that everybody understand that we also have key populations that we are working with. We need to start where people are. We need to even look at the issues of pronouns and you know, create a conversation between our stakeholders to make them comfortable, to create a safe space when we are working in an environment for a better understanding of the people that we are engaging with.
Mm. Thanks, Martin. Did you want to add to that?
Oh, there's a lot.
Succinctly, Martin.
I want to start off, Nozuka and Elliot. I don't know if you know the study. It's called 13,915 Reasons for Equity in Health.
Not
okay. It was specifically done in 2008 to find out why AIDS was such a big issue in South Africa specifically, right? They went out, they interviewed 126,000 boys in 1,192 schools around the country, 9 official languages, right? And the results were this. 44% of all boys had suffered sexual abuse by the age of 18. Okay. Perpetration rates were this. 27% had suffered sexual abuse by both genders, male and female. 32% by men and 41% by women. Now, the reason why I bring this up is that I don't think – I've never met a boy as a 5-year-old boy, and I always say, you know, what do you want to be as an adult? They always go like, I want to be a doctor. I want to be a policeman, a fireman. I want to be Spider-Man, Superman. I've never met one that goes, well, you know what? When I grow up, I want to beat the crap out of my wife or my partner. I've never heard that before. They don't go, you know, when I grow up, I want to be an idiot. When I grow up, I want to be a rapist. I've never heard that. You know, boys, ideologically, they want to be supermen or they want to be heroes, right? So what happens between the age of 5 and the age of 18, 19, 20? Well, one of the things that the study came out with that we – as activists, especially in the male area, we kind of try and deny this, but it's a fact, and we need to look at this. We can't take one part of the science and ignore the next, right? Mm-hmm. So another thing that came out within the study is that boys who have been sexually abused are 4 times more likely to perpetrate a rape, okay? And this is where we started seeing why we had such a prevalent HIV/AIDS pandemic in this country. And it continues. We just like, oh, well, now we can manage it and you can live forever, you know. So we haven't really gone, I don't think we've kept up the prevention side of it, right? But we need to look at this. We need to start talking about these things. And we need to talk, if these boys have been raped and they resort to their 5 coping mechanisms, can we see why we have this escalation of rape, sexual abuse, violence in this country? So we're not addressing the cause. We're just trying to put band-aids on it. We're just trying to fix things, you know, and there's so much in this space that we need to talk about, and we need to start looking at, right, firstly, all the rape crisis centers in this country are for
women,
right, for girls and women. And when people turn around and say, a friend of mine actually did some research into this. She said, in South Africa, there's thousands of rape crisis centers. Right. And she said she went and interviewed 125. I must remember the research. Sorry. She interviewed 125 of them. Of the 125, 10 said that they support males and females. Right. Of the 10, 4 showed one male in their advertising or on their web pages. Right. So what's that message we're sending? You know, we have for girls. Men are kind of a side issue. So we're not fixing the problem. We're not fixing the issues. And we need to look at this, especially in your space. If we if we've got so many boys that have been sexually abused, and this was confirmed in the Optimus study in 2016, 33.9% of girls have suffered sexual abuse by age 16, 36.8% of boys. Why are we not talking about these things? And this is where I get so angry, is like we've genderized this field to such an extent that it's become a war. It's become a, how, you know, pronouns and boys and girls and boys, you bad and you mustn't go out and rape people. And girls, hey, you know, you can carry on doing what you're doing and it's cool, you know, because we're all fine with that. And it's not, you know, we need to change the narrative and we need to change the narrative for both boys and girls. I mean, at the moment, there's this thing going around. Teach your girls that if a boy is abusive to them and treats them badly, that it's not love. I'm going like, you know, why do we do this? Why don't we say, teach your children that if somebody is abusive towards them, it's not love? You know, we've genderized everything to such an extreme that we've essentially excluded boys and you just got to cope with it, you know. But hey, when you do something bad, we're going to call you trash, right? You know?
Yeah. I wanted to get in there. I think the information that is brought about by Martin is for me is new and very interesting, because I've been having the view that not much research has been done in terms of, for instance, sexual abuse of boys, but especially in the black community. I think it is still maybe that outlook that boys do hide and conceal that aspect. But I think Elliot raised interesting thing which I some sort of really concentrate on in my community work, to say he mentioned about the expectation. Nozuko also she mentioned that society expect a man to provide, society expect this and that, you are ridiculed if you are unemployed, etc., and so on and so forth. I think there lies the problem. We need to look at the perception of the society and how it perpetuates the stereotype that result into a boy being violent. When you talk about men as a provider, why don't you balance the equation on a woman as a provider?
Because it's a stereotype.
It's a stereotype. Mm. You know, in my environment, we even had to go for affirmative action of the soldiers. And we realized the impact, the good impact that it has on promoting women to the same level of men. And how it lessens the question of abuse of such empowered women. Now we go back to the family. Elliot, you said the family, the society, the community expect this boy to provide, to assist, to get the work. But you don't realize the economic situation that actually affects that man to be in that pathetic situation. But if you again take that situation into the women section, it will be the same thing. So I think the equal opportunity here, if men and women are given the same opportunity, women will not be vilifying, will not be insulting a man as it is now, because the perception is that you are the savior of the family, etc. But if you bring your salary here and then you compare and reconcile, etc., and so on, that will minimize the attitude of the family looking up to the father being the savior, etc., and so on. I think we need to look at the society, the perception, and the socialization of the families and the attitude itself. Because this one of men are perpetrating this because they are abused, it's not very so clear to many. But the community, I think, the society, the tradition, contributes in forming an element of superiority complex of of men, of the one who's supposed to provide, instead of being scientific to say, you know, it is high time that women are empowered so that we balance the equation. That is my view. Maybe to a certain extent, I'm trying to put across my foundation's view to say gender equality will minimize that. And I think both Nozigo and Elliot are coming up with this. And I think, Tracy, if this discussion, I hope this discussion will not end up at the psychological effect of men being abused by women in one way or the other. But it must come with some solution to say, let's break the so-called customs. If these customs actually perpetuate and result to a boy abusing a woman according to custom as an inferior to her, we must start there. Because that is what's happening in the African community to say, you know, a woman is taken as if it's a subordinate entity. We must start there. So I think if this podcast can really try to look into that, really, as perpetrators, I think men are, I don't think they feel good for rape, for abuse, etc. I think they are, unless they're drug addicts, etc. and so on, they know they are somehow abnormal. And that's why we condemn them. Whatever the argument they put across is criminal, etc. and so on. But they need to be attended to. When I started, it was the question of the medical, as Nozuko is showing, that they are reluctant to be assisted. Social workers, clinical psychologists, psychiatrists, etc. They are reluctant to that because that community beg, if they can hear that you went for counseling, it's going to be a big thing. That hey, listen to that. The next boy went to counseling. Yeah, who could see him? And that's a weakling. So I think the issues that are raised, I consider Nozuko and Elliot as specialists, because in social development, you need really, you are working with this thing every day. And in AIDS, et cetera, health, you are that thing. But they are raising things, the causes, more than the effects, because a rapist, you see the end result of a particular process to say, how can my son, I've never raped, but here is my son doing something unthinkable, etc. We look back and said, oh, but the creation is there. So I am saying the society, we need to challenge the stereotype, the traditional, the customary, the way of looking things from the man point of view. A woman must not be a woman because the men say so, or they are defined by a man. A woman must be a woman because she's a woman. That's my approach. Tradition, customs, and socialization, I think they play a very big role in actually making boys to be those kind of animals, like rape. Because if you rape, I think you are not human. So that is my approach, and I will learn a lot. I'll look into the statistics as indicated by Martin, because for me the majority of GBV are women, and mostly women, really, because evidence is there, research is there, etc. and so on.
It's no research. Sorry.
No, I
want to be convinced. All research that is done is about women who are beaten and men that are perpetrators. There is no research in this country into male victims of gender-based violence. There is none. I guarantee you that.
I refer the research on, and even crime statistics are showing that majority of the abused are women. And of course, that even the research is showing that women are the worst, hardest hit in this regard. I am saying no research. If you are saying, maybe I misunderstood you. If you are saying there is no much research in men being abused, then I agree with you, because I haven't come into contact there are areas that I'm told about, like this Kuluman daughter. I still have to get it because I feel there is a problem there that needs to be resolved.
Mm.
I think we do understand in terms of, there's no research in terms of men suffering.
Gender-based violence.
Yeah.
Mm.
I think another thing is the fact that, you know, we'll see the statistics pointing towards women mostly, because women, they are able to, their health-seeking behaviors or their service-seeking behaviors are much better as compared to women, to men. So men don't report these things because of stigmatization, stigma and discrimination. So the numbers, then they won't balance out because men are scared. What will people say if I go to a social worker?
Or to the police.
They are carrying, or to the police. So they are carrying that burden.
Mm.
So, and then you find that our statistics is actually skewed. And you look at the boy, a boy child. You look at the statistics of boys who are abusing girls. And the increase, I cannot quote the statistics now, but I think the stats from SAPS last year was talking about a majority of boys at the age of 10 already sexually assaulting young girls. Mm. And you wonder, why is this happening? So I want to agree with Danielle as well to say, you know, we need to look at how our society perceives things and start from there, because I think there's a lot that is wrong with our society. Mm-hmm. And the difficult thing is that in our society, for instance, I'm working with a majority of women, and sometimes I must sing feminism all the time because I'm with women who are feminist. Some, you know, at times I don't believe what I'm saying, because it's not only women that are being abused. Men are also abused. And because I don't have the stats to show. And when we talk about IPV, intimate partner violence, which is a phenomenon in our HIV and AIDS space, 56% of women that are experiencing intimate partner violence on annual basis. But what we don't say is, so women, didn't they bring HIV into the family? You know, are they not abusive in some other forms, the other forms of violence that they might inflict to their partners, resulting in them, you know, inflicting pain to the or violence to their women? So we don't have a space to engage further and really look deeper and say, what are the root causes of everything that we are experiencing? And then we've got religious sector as well. It's not helping us. So we need to really look at our belief systems, whether it's traditional and religious sector, when we talk about issues of gender-based violence, mental health, HIV, and other social ills, of course.
I think if I can come in also, just to add to, I think one point that Martin mentioned in terms of when you go to the GBV service provision spots, how you never see, you know, men also, you know, services being provided for men and the lack of services therein. I think when you think about how Mam Nozuke has already spoken about, men have a less health-seeking behavior. And what we can agree is that, you know, mental health is a human challenge, you know. Beyond just gender-based violence, when you think about mental health as a whole, anyone who is a human experiences daily stresses that would want, you know, to be supported. And now that we think about the framework of South Africa, where men on the one side are taught or constructed in a manner where they are unable to say how they feel and how they're experiencing life throughout of all of those, you know, pressing challenges that you see on a daily basis, then it does build the premises that we don't know as much as we need to when it comes to men and their experience. And when we look at the two power dynamics, I know last year we saw an increase in you know, teenage pregnancy. And most of the efforts on the HIV field have been, you know, focused towards the young girl and being able to provide her with enough information and enough resources to be able to protect themselves in terms of condoms or well, medication or pills to prevent pregnancy and all of those services that are being directed to the girl child. But we haven't seen a lot of, you know, similar services being directed to the male child or men. Or when you ask yourself where or who these young girls are being impregnated by, I mean, you look at the statistics, you'll see some of them, it is a, you know, statutory rape. They are underage, but they are pregnant. And it really then needs us to think about how we form our interventions to also speak to men and the services that they need. And without being able to drive that agenda towards men, I think we're going to be missing out on a key intervention aspect when it comes to trying to lower gender-based violence in that essence. Yeah.
Elliot, just before you started talking, I literally took out my phone and I was Googling some stats that I remember from 2 years ago. And I'm so glad you raised it. And I'm just reviewing them now. It was... there were 900 children between the ages of 10 and 14 that were impregnated, right? You remember those statistics. And this article, it's a Mail and Guardian article, actually speaks about the lack of outrage. We should be outraged at those statistics. But I want to use that to point to something that Martin said. All of those pregnant people are girl children, which is how we catch it, right? We catch the fact that some person... And it's frequently not another child who's impregnated them, right? There's a whole grown adult male on the other end of that equation. But boys don't get pregnant. So if someone's doing the same thing to a little boy, he slips right under the radar. And if we look at Martin's stats, that, and it's nearly equitable. I mean, if we, that first study you quoted, the 13,900 reasons why, said 44% of boys are reporting that they've been victims. So if we take that back into an adult male mental health equation, we're saying that the statistics between boys and girls being sexually assaulted is damn close to the same, I would say. It's pretty equitable in childhood, right? So we're kind of saying childhood into early teens. But there's a breaking off point there. Once you hit puberty and then early adulthood, the girls are going in a direction where health-seeking behavior is encouraged and services exist. The boy children are going in a direction where, due to patriarchy and that beautiful description you gave us, Daniel, of the way the system suppresses health-seeking behavior in men and boys, they end up going in a different direction. But if we look at it from a GBV point of view, in the early years, they're being victimized quite equally. And some studies show that boys even a little more frequently than girls. But we're catching the girls because they get pregnant. We're catching the girls because this helps more health-seeking behaviors. And the services exist for them. And I'm going to say that with a disclaimer, we know the services are not available equally to the same extent and with the same quality. But we know that they exist much more than they would for guys. And so I think there's such a golden thread here between Daniel's emphasis on the way the patriarchal system creates, it's creating a psychological and emotional disability in a sense. So patriarchy serves no one. That's my firm belief. It serves absolutely nobody. Everyone is getting hurt, but just in different ways. So men are robbed of the language of their emotions, robbed of the right to even have emotions, to talk about what hurts them. There's no services for them. and then they end up with dysfunctional coping mechanisms. Whereas for women, there are more services, more opportunities to talk, but by virtue of being women and the way patriarchy frames us, we're more likely to also become a victim of all sorts of systemic inequalities. You were talking, Daniel, about you know, elevating women through the ranks in the military spaces when what was that lovely thing? What's it called again?
The affirmative action.
That's the one. Yes. When that starts to level the playing field. And I want to pick up on something you said earlier, Elliot, which really struck me. And I'm paraphrasing what you said because I'm trying to capture the essence of it. It sounds to me like patriarchal concepts of masculinity, these traditional concepts of masculinity, actually reject the feminine, which is why persons who are not male and female or man and woman and find themselves in the space between and are trying to identify and fight for their voice in the space, they come under fire because they're actually incorporating the feminine as well. Does that make sense to you? Did I capture that well? Because I'm trying to understand how patriarchy is the common thread here.
Yeah. So I think when you think about, you know, gender diverse people who don't necessarily fall under the spectrum of, you know, cisgender, even in that aspect, if you think about the hate crimes we've seen in a lot of lesbian women for, you know, presenting as masculine, and you listen to their stories and how now when you think about masculinity, it's learned behavior. So even for someone who is trying to find themselves, they are marinated within a spectrum of these two binaries that we are all born into. And not only do you then take the trait of masculinity, but you also take the toxic aspect of it, that if you are, you know, now a lesbian identifying woman, then you start being, you know, wanting to activate that masculine aspect of you by having a bit of force, a bit of violence, because that's what you're seeing. And this is how, you know, masculinity is being portrayed within your society. And for someone who then identifies or feels more effeminate, then you start getting to those effeminate traits to say, maybe I shouldn't speak my mind as I should. You know, you take back on some of the ideas or some of the traits that are seen to be more masculine about a person. You still feel more, you know, vulnerable. You find more men or trans women who effeminate presenting would likely not be able to defend themselves because they feel, because I'm effeminate, I can't be fighting. But that's something that, you know, it's a human character. It's a part of you being able to protect yourself. And we speak about, you know, I'd make an example when you go into a club, for instance, and someone says, you know, for females, they shouldn't pay, but the men should pay. And already within those, you know, kind of small, and it's very subtle in terms of how we do it and how we construct these and how we police these gender norms ourselves in society. And we speak about stigma and stereotypes, but we forget these are individual opinions that form these stereotypes. So we are responsible as a society of how, you know, we have developed each other to become this, you know, community that we are in. And because it takes so much time, it's going to take the very same time to start, you know, unlearning some of the things that we learned in the beginning. So I think in that sense, that for someone who is still, you know, trying to understand themselves within the spectrum of gender, it's a very critical aspect, because you also now are acknowledging everything about that particular gender, and it's very easy to also take in some of the traits that might not be as positive towards your development as a person.
Yeah, you know, Martin reminded us of the rancor or anger of women referring to us as trash. I think every thinking, reasonable man will understand that feeling. Tracy, I'm having a problem that the society created this monster that is the rapist, and this rapist being a man. But you seem not to take it. Yes, we differ. I'll have to give me You know, I can give a long history why I'm always some sort of differing with statistics that are brought about by Martin. Mm-hmm. That these people who are abusing, or let me be very blunt to say, the rapists, one can say those people are sick, and that's why this discussion is very important, that they be helped as perpetrators. And I did indicate that, you know, the society, the community, stereotypes are responsible for creating that monster. Mm. But I have a problem that we seem to be acting and be engaged in Hollywood and in malapropism in serious situations. For instance, somebody will say GBV is a pandemic and we leave it there and go and drink our beer. But I think we need to go a step further, but especially from the social workers and the social development and the legal judiciary, to say, why is the rape not considered as an illness, psychological or whatever? Illness, because already it has been taken as pandemic, which is illness or a disease affecting mainly men. My concern is the question of the very society itself. You know, the Minister of Basic Education instituted a commission to investigate, inter-ministerial task team to investigate this thing of the GBV school and in the school environment. And Professor Paul Mink did indicate that the teachers are so heavily involved in abusing the girls and even the female teachers. Professor Paul Mink actually indicated that for a young lady teacher to get a post, the probability is that she must go via the bathroom to get that post.
God.
And you know what made me sad was that the unions involved in teachers, whatever, they attack the minister like there's no tomorrow. Now, this evidence is there, but the teachers are refusing to say this pandemic exists within that sector. So where do we hide if teachers are people we are looking up to as knowledge practitioners and knowledge providers? So I think really this topic needs to blow, if need be, to destroy those stereotypes to a great extent, because when you look at the teachers being involved in this, what about the illiterates in the township, in the rural areas, etc., and so on? Now, but I will ask the two specialists there: why are we not taking rape as illness, and not only talk about the mental wellness of men, but to say those people are sick, it must be treated likewise, and give prominence to the clinical psychologists, etc., and so on, to say they must declare war on this matter. That's really my concern.
Oh, geez. Thank you, Daniel. There was so much. I don't even know where to start. There was so much in that. I think and we're almost out of time, so I'm going to start wrapping us up. But I think what was really important was that we're condemning the action, but helping the person. And I think rounding up rapists and just throwing them in prison without treating, you know, the root causes and giving them the actual help for recovery is just a huge disservice to humanity. I want to just come to Martin, and Martin, you can also just give your closing comment. But I saw your face when Daniel said men are rapists, And I just want to remind us all that according to that study you referenced earlier, up to 41% of the boys who are reporting sexual assault had been sexually assaulted by women. I think where we're seeing the difference is that in childhood, children are vulnerable to both genders of perpetrators, men and women. But in adulthood, it's much more physically difficult for a woman to hold down a man and rape him. So I think when we talk about rapists, we mustn't only talk about what we're seeing as an adult event, you know, and in that instance, there's definitely more male rapists than females, or inversely more female victims than male victims. Mm. But in childhood, and I want us to walk away with real clarity on this, in childhood, the rapists are pretty much well evenly divided. In fact, if I'm, and I'm just noting back to your stats, Martin, in the Optima study, it was 36% of boys were reporting that they'd been sexually assaulted. In the 13,000 reasons, it was 44%. But the perpetrator
rate. Change of consent, the age of consent.
Yes, exactly.
So it was 16, 18.
Yeah, to your age groups. But I think what is important is to remember that 32% of those perpetrations were committed by men, whereas it was 41% of women. So we're going to fool ourselves if we say that all rapists are men. I think the women are just the women rapists, the women sexual assault people out there are targeting children versus targeting adult men. I think they're smart enough to know that it'd be very difficult to do that to, you know, a sober, cognizant adult male. And I want us to really be clear that we're not forgetting the children in this equation. And that's important from a mental health point of view, because it is those same children who grow up to become perpetrators of all sorts of things, right? Not just GBV, but a ton of different social ills. The same children, and we're talking about the boy child now, for whom there are no services, as Martin pointed out, for whom stigma, because of the way patriarchy frames masculinity, stigma is a monumental barrier to those health-seeking behaviors you were talking about, Nozuko. Just the ridicule that people would experience if someone saw them entering the psychologist's office, for example. And so I think there are so many threads in all of what we've been talking about that lead to, you know, the mental health of men as being at crisis point. And I don't think we can make a dent in GBV without talking about the mental health of men. I don't think we can run away from the fact that South Africa currently has the highest suicide rate for men in the world. And that number is very strongly leaning towards black men between the ages of 18 and 35. There, our young black men are in massive crisis from a mental health point of view. And yes, unemployment, and yes, education opportunities. And there's so many things that plug into that. But I'm just trying to like put us in a nutshell to walk away with. So I'm going to stop there and just give everyone a minute to just leave us with your parting comment. And if you could have the listeners today walk away with one important thing that you want them to know, what would that one thing be? I'm going to start with you, Martin.
Gee, you're not giving everybody else a chance here.
I'm going to get to them.
So I think my main thing is, and what I've noticed is that everything evil that we see in society today is essentially wedged in childhood trauma. And we need to start looking at that. South Africa being one of the highest rates of fatherlessness, 62% of our children grow up without fathers. And there was at the Labour Museum at the bottom end of Joburg, a saying that I saw on the wall there, and the guy wrote, he said, "I hope my sons are not kept from their wives as their father was from their mother." And when you look at that and the insidious nature of forced labor that happened 100 years ago, where men were taken away from their families and put into mines thousands of kilometers away from their families, boys had to then suddenly grow up without fathers and that sort of stuff. So bear these things in mind. I mean, there's, you know, we can't drill down into one single thing that causes all of this, but essentially it's childhood trauma. I mean, growing up with only one parent is deemed to be one of those childhood traumas that we deal with. Poverty is one of those. When we look at the poverty in this country, you know, it's an indication. Violence, another one. Addiction, you know, that sort of stuff. We can carry on. But it's that. And then we also need to start understanding that violence is not the sole domain of men. You know, in studies done in Italy recently, they found that there was more GBV in lesbian couples, so 42%, as opposed to gay couples, 31%, as opposed to heterosexual couples, 25%. Mm. So violence is more prevalent in the lesbian community, which speaks to what Eliot said, is these girls trying to be more masculine because of, you know, whatever reason. And I see it, again, drill back to childhood violence, childhood trauma. Mm. So until we as a society start addressing the root evils, childhood trauma, nothing's going to change. Until we create spaces where little boys, little girls can start talking about the pains that they experience in life, nothing's going to change. Until we create spaces where young boys feel free to talk about their hurts, nothing's going to change. You know, and we need to start addressing that issue. We need to start looking at things realistically. You know, stop this genderized thing. You know, I keep saying it, and it's a fact. It's a human problem, not a gender issue. And we need to start approaching life from that perspective.
Mm, thank you, Martin. Nozuko, I'm going to come to you. Closing comments, last words of wisdom.
Thank you, Tracy, and thanks to the fellow panelists. You know, as we were discussing this this morning, what came to mind, especially when Eliot cited the fact that these are learned behaviors and we have to unlearn. Mm. And the easiest way for me and practical will be, you know, let's start whilst our children are still young, because I think it's really difficult looking at, I'll go back to my metaphor of an onion. When you look at what constitutes these behaviors and the things that we see as a problem, actually there's a lot that has happened to that human being. And also, you know, we've got different disciplines and, you know, we spoke about children committing crime, and I'm even thinking about Department of Social Development. You know, they've got those centers that they are for children who are in conflict with the law. Already, we are stigmatizing that center instead of correcting it. And then when you go to correctional services, we say it's a correctional services. What is the difference between where children are being kept and where adults are being kept? Mm. Shouldn't we take a more positive approach in looking at these issues and use our social workers and our psychologists to have a deeper understanding what has gone wrong to a person before we can label that person as a rapist? Because there's an issue, as Daniel was saying, why don't we call it an illness? And I mean, I've just looked at at one of the studies, and they are saying rapist is not, it's a behavior, it's a pathological behavior. So you look at the way we label these things, and we perpetuate, we continuously perpetuate all these social ills that we are experiencing. So as practitioners, as activists, as professionals in different disciplines, we have to really look deeply in this issue rather than superficially. Thank you.
Mm, thanks, Nozuko. Eliot, I want to keep you for last. Can you hang on for a... I can see you rearing to go. Daniel, please.
Thank you. Briefly, I must say, I think Nozuko enlightened me that to rape is not an illness. I was trying to raise it to that level. Maybe we need a redefinition. Mm. But given the topic, I do believe that rapists specifically needs help. If the society can focus on that, but more than that, really, I think the society, the community, the customs and traditions will have to relook at it, because I believe they produce the unwanted products like what we are talking about. So the root cause need to be looked at seriously from my point of view. Thanks.
Thanks, Daniel. Elliot?
Yes. Thank you so much, colleague. I think this was such an insightful conversation, especially on, you know, some of the statistics. And I'm just drawing also from what Martin said in terms of most, you know, violence that happens within children, you know, we are all responsible for that. And, you know, Tracy, if I could really tell the community one thing, in terms of GBV and mental health and men, is that we really need to start thinking about how we contribute to the social construction of our society. And it's a very subtle nature in how each and everyone's opinions from the household. I mean, you think about the children now and how Mom knows what it says, we need to start unlearning particular things. But it's a cycle of information that really needs to start changing. It's not just the children, but it's also their parents and how they understand, you know, how we socialize. So each and every one of us as an individual is responsible for that. I mean, you go to a restaurant, you see a man-sized meal and you're forced to eat more as a man because you think that's what society wants from you, not to pick the veggies. Or we say things like you hit like a girl, but we don't see how that is disempowering to a female person. And if you take 10 girls and you tell them, show me how you hit, they don't actually hit that soft. So it's those kind of little nuances that we need to start thinking about as parents, as individuals, as adults within society, and think about how these comments build and change behavior of the future we're trying to see for South Africa. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Elliot.
I never realized that's why I'm overweight.
Man-sized meals. And as Elliot was talking, I was thinking about,
my eyes,
you go to a restaurant and there's a steak and then there's a lady's steak. I'm like, what the hell? Why am I getting unfair discrimination of my portion size? I too would like a man-sized steak, please. But, Elliot, you're so right. It lives in the subtleties. Hey? It lives in the subtleties. Oh, you hit like a girl. You run like a girl. You
eat
know,
like a lady's steak.
You eat a lady's steak. Yeah, for us it was always so I'm one of three sisters. For us it was, you know, sit with your back up straight and cross your legs and act like a lady. And I'm like, what does that mean?
What is
actually
a lady?
And now when people say I'm a lady, I'm genuinely offended by that, because ladies are quiet.
Yes.
They spend all their time and money and resources on looking pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And they just uphold the value of a man. That's actually research. That is the definition of what people think a lady actually is. Yeah. So I'm like, I'm neither quiet. I'm not using all my resources to make myself look pretty. And I'm not just sitting here boying up, you know, some guy somewhere. Mm. So please don't call me a lady. I will be highly offended. my parting shot for us today is, and I'm weaving together all the threads of what we've spoken about, and I think shame is a part of our equation, and it hasn't come up in our conversation, but if patriarchy has got this dictatorship of what masculinity should look like, and masculinity has all these toxic, very unhelpful traits. If you are experiencing any kind of violence, or you're a victim of domestic violence or psychological or physical, emotional abuse, because of the patriarchal dictatorship of how you're supposed to be as a man, you're going to feel a lot of shame within yourself. Like you're somehow not unworthy as a man. You're not good enough as a man. You know, all of this internal narrative. And that will keep you from seeking help. But it also then drives you, because shame is a driver of dysfunctional coping, Martin. So into our drugs and alcohol and sex and even workaholism is a dysfunctional coping mechanism. And so I think shame really interweaves. It's almost like the living part of this equation that keeps people from speaking out and seeking help. But I also want to talk to the community of people who are perpetrating something in their own environments. So imagine if you're a perpetrator of something and you feel like crap because you're doing it and you want to get out of the cycle of this thing that you're doing. Where do you go for help that you're not going to get put in jail? Like you want to get help for your, let's say, your domestic violence. But if you go and tell someone, hey, I'm outing myself and I'm a perpetrator of domestic violence and I want help, the closest you'll get perhaps is the police now coming to knock on your door because you've self-identified. Mm-mm. You know, so how do you get help? How does, because shame, I'm just putting myself in someone's shoes. Shame would lock me down. I would not go and say a word about how I'm being abusive, how I'm being controlling, how I'm sexually assaulting. Even if I just wanted to get therapeutic help for my behavior, I wouldn't be able to do it. Because number one, it doesn't really exist. And number two, if it did exist, you'd get the law before you got the help. And shame would just keep me in the dark and closeted about all of those things. And I think, and you'd alluded to it earlier, Daniel, I think a lot of men know they're doing wrong and harmful things. Mm-hmm. And I must say that I fundamentally believe that all people are good, but they all have, your childhood traumas, bad experiences and so forth that pushes us down a road. But I think if we gave most people the chance to be better, they would take it. If we gave most people the opportunity and said, you know, do you want to be a better person? Do you want to shed this cloak of pain and disappointment and addiction and mental ill health and abusive things? If you could just take it off like a backpack and leave it on the ground, I think most people would. I don't think there is a man alive who's doing these things and I mean, unless you've got serious psychological issues.
No, there are men, yeah, who don't want to change.
That's what I'm disclaiming now. Yeah. Unless there are those with some serious psychological issues, but we're not talking about them. We're talking about the bulk of humanity.
Yeah.
What I would like people to take away with today is, if you know someone who is struggling with mental health issues, if you know someone who is a victim of gender-based violence or is perpetrating that violence, if you know a man who's in struggle, who's in crisis, and you can see it, pick up the phone, check on him, take him out for a coffee, see if he needs support, reach out, because in that way you can take some personal responsibility for breaking down the stigmas, breaking down the barriers. And when we look at the suicide rate in this country, you could very well be saving a life just by making that call. And I'm going to leave us there. Thank you, everyone, for your time today. It was a really good, robust conversation. And I hope to see you all again in future conversations. Go well.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tracy.
Nice meeting everyone.
Enjoy your
day. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Heal Your Mind podcast with Tracy Kotzen is hosted by Mental Wellness Initiative and supported by the Ford Foundation.